Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. Welcome, curious listeners, to the deep dive. Today, we're stepping back a bit, back into a really pivotal moment in literary history, a time when one man's, well, massive work really reshaped how we think about poets, poetry, even why art matters.
That's right. We're undertaking a deep dive into Samuel Johnson's extraordinary lives of the English poets. Now, it's from the 18th century, obviously.
Right.
But its insights into how we evaluate creativity and, you know, the people behind it, they feel incredibly relevant today.
Yeah.
It really makes you think about that link between creator and creation.
Absolutely. So our mission today is to unpack Johnson's, well, groundbreaking ideas, look at his critical judgments, which could be pretty sharp, by the way.
Oh, definitely.
And figure out why these essays are still such a cornerstone. We'll look at that fascinating link between a writer's life and their work and what that means for how you might approach, well, any creative work you encounter.
Yeah, from a classic novel to, say, a new movie or even something like a business plan.
Exactly. So, okay, first things first. Who was this Samuel Johnson? Often just called Dr. Johnson, his era is literally called the Age of Johnson. That's pretty big. What made him such a giant?
He really was an intellectual powerhouse.
Yeah.
A true polymath. Poet, essayist, moralist, critic, and maybe most famously, a lexicographer.
The dictionary guy.
The dictionary guy, yeah. His Dictionary of the English Language was just staggering. A solo effort that basically standardized English for, what, over 100 years?
Wow.
And Lives of the English Poets, this book we're diving into, it was the culmination of this long career. He was commissioned when he was nearly 70.
70, taking on that. That's incredible. What gave him the authority or maybe the confidence to tackle something that huge, basically defining the English literary canon?
Well, several things. He had this encyclopedic knowledge of literature, for starters, a really sharp analytical mind, and his writing style.
The Johnsonian style.
Exactly. Known for its clarity, its balance. But crucially, beyond just the intellect, he was a profound moralist. He really believed literature wasn't just, you know, entertainment. It was a powerful tool for shaping character, promoting what he called a piety and virtue. So it's this mix, deep literary knowledge, razor-sharp judgment, and this strong moral philosophy. That combo made him the authority, really. He wasn't just critiquing poems. He was kind of judging the moral health of the nation through its literature.
Okay, so let's talk about the book itself, Lives of the English Poets. It didn't start out as this grand project, did it? It was more like small beginnings.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, it started pretty modestly. Yeah. London booksellers asked him to write some brief biographical prefaces.
Just little intros.
Lovely intros for a new collection of English poets. But Johnson being Johnson, well, it grew. It blossomed into one of the most important works of English literary criticism ever. 52 essays, biographical and critical, covering poets from the mid-17th to mid-18th century, he basically created a national literary history on the fly.
52. That's a lot more than a few prefaces. So what was he really getting at? What's the big idea here? More than just life stories.
Oh, much more.
Yeah.
The core insight, the revolutionary part, is Johnson insisting you can't fully grasp a poet's work without looking at their life, their character, their morals, you know? He kind of pioneered this blend of biography and textual analysis. They're linked, inseparable for him. He's asking these big questions. What is great poetry? What kind of life makes a great poet? And ultimately, what's literature for?
And for him, the answer was?
Pretty clear cut. Literature's highest goal is to instruct and delight, to teach wisdom and virtue, but through beauty, through clarity.
So it's not just a who's who. It's a judgment call. A standard being set for poetic excellence based on clarity, reason, universal truth, and moral integrity. A real deep dive into the soul of English poetry. And Johnson didn't just talk theory, did he? He really applied this method to individual poets. His judgments could be pretty, well, let's say complex. Let's look at a few examples, see how his method worked.
Okay, good idea. First up, maybe Abraham Cowley. Johnson uses him to define and really critique a whole school. The metaphysical poets.
Ah, the metaphysicals, John Donne and the like.
Exactly. Johnson argued that poets like Cowley, chasing novelty, trying to be clever, ended up with a style that was maybe intellectually impressive, yeah, but often felt emotionally cold, unnatural even. His famous line was that the most heterogeneous ideas are yoked by violence together. He accused them of using these complex metaphors, these conceits, instead of showing real feeling.
Yoked by violence together. Oof. That's a strong critique. Really sets a high bar for what he thought was natural or good poetry. Okay, who's next? John Milton. That's one of the longest lives, right? And he was really torn about Milton.
Absolutely torn. Yeah. Johnson gives this pretty harsh picture of Milton the man. Calls him an acrimonious and surly Republican because of his politics, his support for Cromwell.
Johnson was a staunch royalist, wasn't he?
Very much so. He
Yeah.
just couldn't stand Milton's politics. But then he turns to the poetry and the tone just shifts.
Right.
He gives Paradise Lost incredible praise. Calls it, let me get this right, a poem which, with respect to design, may claim the first place, and with respect to performance the second, among the productions of the human mind. High praise indeed.
The second best ever performed? Wow. But even then, there was that famous line about it being a duty rather than a pleasure, wasn't that? I have to admit, some classics still feel like that. You admire them, but.
Exactly. Johnson was brutally honest. He knew that even genius could be, well, hard work. He never pulled his punches. He said, Paradise Lost is a book which the reader admires and lays down and forgets to take up again.
Huh. Okay.
None ever wished it longer than it is. Its perusal is a duty rather than a pleasure. He respected it immensely, but didn't pretend it was an easy read.
So from that complexity, we move to poets where Johnson's own ideals really seem to align. Like John Dryden and Alexander Pope, he saw them as the peak, right?
He really did. Johnson held him in very high esteem, credited him with developing the heroic couplet, you know, those rhyming pairs of lines, often iambic pentameter.
Making it a powerful tool for argument, for satire. Elegant, but also logical. Johnson saw Dryden as the one who taught English poets how to think in verse. The start of the modern correct era for him.
And Pope.
Pope was the absolute pinnacle of that correctness. Perfect harmony, sound, sense, meter. Johnson fiercely defended Pope's status as a great poet. He famously asked, basically challenging critics, if Pope be not a poet, where is poetry to be found?
That idea of correctness, though, it sounds like a very specific taste. Did it
Yeah.
sometimes maybe blind him to other kinds of poetic greatness?
It definitely shaped his judgments, yeah. Which brings us to an interesting case, Richard Savage.
Ah, the tragic one.
Yeah, this life is different, much more sympathetic in tone. Savage's life was just a mess. Misfortune, scandal, debt. He died in debtor's prison. And Johnson had actually been friends with him back when they were both struggling in London.
So the criticism of the poetry was maybe gentler, much gentler. It feels less like literary judgment and more like this powerful cautionary tale about how personal instability, lack of character maybe, can just destroy talent. It shows a more, well, compassionate side of Johnson.
That's important to see because he could be so tough elsewhere.
Exactly. And then finally, let's touch on Thomas Gray. Gray really shows the limits of Johnson's taste, his neoclassical ideals.
Okay, neoclassical taste. Remind us quickly what that means for Johnson.
Sure. Neoclassicism in the 18th century valued order, reason, balance, clarity. Following classical Greek and Roman models, Johnson was squarely in that camp.
Got it. And Gray.
Gray was sort of transitional. Johnson gave absolutely magnificent praise to Gray's elegy written in a country churchyard. He said, "It abounds with images which find a mirror in every mind, and with sentiments to which every bosom returns an echo."
Wow. That's his ultimate compliment, right? Universality.
Exactly, the highest praise. But Gray's other big poems, the Pindaric Odes, Johnson just dismissed them, called them obscure, artificial, too difficult.
And Pindaric Odes would have been more wild, complex lyric.
Yeah, less tidy, less correct than the heroic couplets he loved. So Johnson, with his preference for order and clarity, he just couldn't really get on board with that emerging pre-romantic style that valued, you know, wild imagination over strict rules. Shows he was definitely a man of his time.
Okay, so taking all these individual lives together, what are the big takeaways for us today? The main themes Johnson was driving at, how do they still, speak to us?
Well, a few core themes really stand out. First, and maybe most central for him, was the moral purpose of literature. Johnson truly believed that writing's ultimate value, its highest calling, was to make the reader better, wiser, to promote piety and virtue, as he put it.
That's a strong stance. It makes you wonder, do we still expect that from art today, or is entertainment kind of enough now? What do you think?
It's a constant tension, isn't it? We value entertainment, sure, but I think there's still a hunger for art that moves us, challenges us, maybe even teaches us something profound. Johnson would say the best art always does that. Second big theme, the interconnection of life and art. He just wouldn't separate them. A poet's character, their pride, their flaws, their choices, it all bled into the work. For him, he wasn't a believer in art for art's sake.
Which feels incredibly relevant today, right?
This whole debate about separating the creator from the creation, public figures, artists, can we really do it? Does knowing about the person change how you see their work? Johnson seems to say, no, you can't separate them.
Pretty much. He'd probably find our modern debates fascinating, but ultimately argue it's naive to think they're totally separate. The person shapes the work. Third, his standard of general nature. His highest praise went to work that tapped into universal human experience. Poetry should speak to common emotions, shared feelings, things that resonate with everyone.
So that feeling you get when a story or a song just clicks, regardless of when or where it was made, that's tapping into general nature.
I think that's exactly what he meant. Those fundamental human drives, love, loss, ambition, fear. When art captures those authentically, it lasts. Johnson knew we're all fundamentally similar deep down. And finally, number four, championing Augustan correctness. Like we discussed with Pope and Dryden, he valued clarity, reason, balance, perfect meter. The heroic couplet was his ideal for logical thought and moral reflection, presented elegantly.
It makes you think, in our world of, you know, Twitter threads and quick takes, how important is that kind of clarity and precision in how you communicate? Does elegance still matter?
I'd argue it matters more than ever. Maybe the forms change, but the core idea, expressing complex things clearly, persuasively, without being obscure or pretentious, that's timeless. Johnson's correctness was about impact.
And Johnson himself was such a master stylist. His own writing and Lives of the English Poets is full of these memorable lines, isn't it? Lines that really nail his whole philosophy.
Oh, absolutely. It's incredibly quotable. We've mentioned a few, but let's recap some key ones. Of course, there's that zinger about the metaphysicals from the life of Cali. The most heterogeneous ideas are yoked by violence together.
Right. His put down of forced cleverness over genuine feeling, a classic critical line.
And then the opposite, his passionate defense of his ideal from the life of Pope. If Pope be not a poet, where is poetry to be found? Basically saying, if you don't count wit, reason, moral insight, and perfect technique as poetry, what are you counting?
He also had that beautiful phrase for universality.
Yes, praising Gray's elegy in the life of Gray. The churchyard abounds with images which find a mirror in every mind and with sentiments to it that every bosom returns an echo. That's his gold standard,
yeah.
Speaking to everyone's experience.
And we definitely can't forget his wonderfully honest, almost backhanded compliment to Milton.
Oh yeah, it's brilliant. From the life of Milton. Paradise Lost is one of the books which the reader admires and lays down and forgets to take up again. Its perusal is a duty rather than a pleasure.
Yeah.
Genius, yes. Important, yes. What? Easy reading, not so much.
Ah, so true.
And maybe one more, just summing up his core belief. Nothing can please many and please long, but just representations of general nature. Enduring art reflects universal truths.
So, okay, this is an 18th century book about long-dead poets. But the way Johnson thought, his approach, it offers really practical lessons for you listening today, doesn't it? Lessons in critical thinking, communication, things way beyond poetry.
Absolutely. First, it's a model for holistic judgment. Johnson teaches us to look at the whole picture when evaluating anything, art, news, a proposal at work. Who made it? Why? What's their angle?
Right.
Integrating the life with the work gives you a much richer, more nuanced understanding. You get beyond just surface impressions.
That feels like a vital skill today with so much information flying around, digging deeper.
Definitely. Second, the importance of clarity in communication. Johnson's focus on clarity, logic, precision. That's timeless advice. Whether you're writing an email, giving a presentation, whatever, being able to express complex ideas clearly without jargon is just invaluable.
And his point about character shaping the work.
That leads to the third application.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding the connection between character and creation. Thinking about how your own values, your ethics, your integrity influence what you produce. Excellence, Johnson implies, isn't just talent. It's also about discipline, honesty, character. We see that debated all the time now with public figures.
Mm-hmm. And finally, he's just great practice for reading critically.
He really is. Number four, developing critical reading skills. Johnson shows you how to read actively, how to analyze an argument, weigh evidence, spot stylistic tricks, and form your own judgment. In an age of overload, being able to tell the substantial from the superficial, crucial. He helps you figure out the purpose behind any message you encounter.
What really stands out to me, wrapping this up, is how Johnson makes literary criticism feel important. Not just some dusty academic thing, but this lively, moral, intellectual wrestling match. It's about the work, yeah, but it's also about the person behind them and what they're trying to say about life. It makes me think differently about everything I read or watch now.
Yeah, I agree. And for me, maybe the biggest lesson is how deeply human literature is. It's made by people, flawed, complex, striving people. And its real value is how it speaks to our shared humanity, our common ground. It really pushes you to ask, what is art for? Does it always have to teach us something, like Johnson believed? Or is delight, pure enjoyment, sometimes enough? What do you think?
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akhotra Foundation.